Yeah, thank you both for your rich presentations. We didn't expect this, but the time has already progressed quite a lot. So I think we should maybe immediately ask if there are already some questions from the audience. Are there any? Yes, there is one. Well, can you get a microphone? Hold on a second.
Thank you. Ayesha, I'd like to attempt to defend the honor of Pete Seeger just a little bit
against
accusations of carpet bagging and condescension. I know that the position of white people liking black music tends to bring almost inevitably accusations of false consciousness. It's sort of hard to get out of that. But as far as I understand it, his project in the South was a continuation of Alan Lomax's in the 40s and his visits to the Southern prisons. And those were, at least in comparison to Lomax's father, anything but condescending. I'd like to know where you see the condescension and the colonialism here.
Well, I think the first statement that he says that about the sort of improved conditions of this prison. I mean, it's essentially chain gang work that's sort of being recapitulated. So I think that that voice from the outside, it needs some kind of mediation, it needs some kind of self-consciousness.
But do you really sense approval of what he's seeing in that voice? I mean, there is, I think, historical fact in the improvement from, say, the 20s, which were much more brutal. But I hear nothing of approval of the tension, Texas chain gang system in that voiceover.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
I heard nothing of approval of the Texas chain gang system in that voiceover.
Or, but of the for prison facility, I mean, there is something about the prison facilities sort of having, I guess I'm coming from the position that this form of work and this form of incarceration is just inherently problematic. So
I think he would agree with you wholeheartedly. One has also, I think, to think about what audience he's making this for and when it was made. The negative message is there. It's perhaps subtle, but it's definitely there. Also in the camera work, I mean, if you look up at the guard on his horse, that's not a friendly person.
Sorry, I didn't hear the last
one. If you look at the guard on his horse, that is not a friendly person, not in this film. I don't see approval. But
well, I mean, the point that I also kind of want to sort of highlight is this sort of this sort of slippage that we heard on the first night, I think it was the first night, it's been a lot of presentations, about the dangers of speaking for and speaking to, right? And so I think that in a sense, the kind of en masse sort of display of labor as opposed to individualized voices and the kind of sources that I've read that are really sort of about the agency of this person coming from the outside. I mean, I don't want to target Pete Seeger in any kind of way, but there is a kind of voice from the outside that kind of resonates with a kind of strain of an anthropological kind of incursion, right? And I think that that's the point I want to make.
Mm. More questions? Here's one. You get a microphone from over there.
Kodwa, I'd like to ask you a question. I'm not going to directly address your central argument, but I wanted to trouble maybe complicate the notion of the industrialization of the voice by asking you if you think there's a relationship between the industrialization of the voice that you tracked, the throwing of the voice, and the industrialization of vision that is quite clear in the clip that you decided to show, where it's ostensibly about a voice, but in fact, you said that the camera has to find its own tempo, but I was wondering what camera are you referring to, because there were at least three cameras going on. The broadcaster was looking at cameras, and then he took binoculars to look at a camera, so we weren't sure what particular camera he was looking at. You were addressing it as one camera, so I'm wondering if the proliferation of visual techniques is somehow related to the industrialization of the proliferation of vocal techniques, perhaps, or the throwing of the voice, the different voices that are actually taking place in that broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, I was referring, to Dario Schwarzstein, Dario Schwarzstein, And I presume it's a hymn. His camera, which has this kind of elegant way of mediating between the perspective out of the window, the perspectives on the monitors, and this kind of hyperbolic temporality of the commentator, the way in which the camera seems to find the right speed of movement and the right way to somehow navigate in that kind of elliptoid motion. That's what I was referring to, the way in which the camera finds its way between all these different kind of perceptual apparatuses, and the way in which the voice then sits there inside of that, and is something like a Virgil, a kind of a guide through that forest of images, and does it all in a kind of extremely kind of eloquent and elegant way, such that it's only, it's on subsequent viewing that you realize how much is going on within that space. There is a relation between the kind of amplification and hyperbole that the voice has to go. The training the voice has to go to keep up with the race and to be a voice for broadcasting, and the relation between the screens. I wouldn't like to write a diagram for it, but there is some kind of amplification that the voice has to go. It has to take up more space. It has to become more intensified each time. It has to lean into the vowel sounds. It has to create its own cadence and its own pacing. It has to develop a kind of internal dynamic that sits inside of the cadence and the pacing and the tempo. And it's as if all of that is an attempt to do for the voice what cameras can do for vision. It's as if the voice has to develop these extra dimensions of range and intensity and cadence. And I hear in that elaboration, in that internal dynamic plasticity, I hear something like a calling. I guess what my presentation tried to do was continue that. It's kind of to speculatively hear that in other moments which are outside of the frame and have nothing to do with it specifically, but can be made to speculatively answer back to what you hear. I was very intrigued by the kind of, like whatever the vocal equivalent of a cineplasticity is, the kind of plasmatic voice. Mm. Plasticity, we're used to thinking about them in terms of animation, in terms of that kind of Eisenstein's capacity to see that kind of stretching and that kind of exuberance inside of a cartoon body. And I can hear some of that going on there inside of the voice. And part of my pleasure is to see that linked to Aisha's point about the elegance and the kind of the relaxedness of the gestures, and then in relation to this extremely controlled camera.
Where I was going with, this is interesting, but I was trying to suggest that perhaps it's not one voice. Perhaps it's one person speaking multiple voices. That's why it's going so fast. It's a call and response. One horse is going, the other horse is going, you know, like in an auction, where the vocalizer is vocalizing the different people that are putting their hands up. So he's speaking for them.
Sure.
So it's a fragmentation of the voice. You're making it sound like it's one voice. I'm trying to suggest that, like the visual imagery, which is fragmented, the voices, there's an echo of the vocal and the visual fragmentation taking place.
Sure, yeah. No, I would accept that. I think, the question of virtuosity is gesturing towards a question of a kind of enhanced, what you call a kind of multiplication, you know. Because this is a voice for broadcasting. This is a voice that's projecting in the ear of the behearer. There is a mass audience who are both hearing and watching the race, of which we, in a sense, see the reverse. You know, that they see images without a voice. We see the back of a head with a voice that emerges from that reverse perspective. So we are in the kind of hidden reverse of that broadcast, that kind of broadcasting dimension. So yeah. There is undoubtedly a dimension of a mass voice. I'm not sure if I would agree with you that it's. I guess it's a question of multiplication. It's a question of how we understand that multiplication.
Is there another question over there, Nora Alter?
I had a question based. I mean, just looking at the two readings and sort of or your two presentations. So I found it interesting that you kind of moved from the voice in that image of ultraviolet as an incarnation of capitalism to the image of the auctioneer and how much wood could a woodchuck chuck. moving to what was described as yucky music in the yucky pop song. Also, the sort of condemnation of Pete Seeger's film, and I have to agree with Peter Schwartz's comment there. But in contrast to a sort of valorization of the song as a site, as a point of resistance, when we don't have an image attached to it. So in the two instances, Kodwo, where you played the recordings and we had the lights dimmed, but it wasn't really a film. So I guess the question that I would pose to both panelists is there something then about the matching of the song with the image that is problematic? And I'm sure, you know, Kodwo, you disagree in your own work. You've done so much work precisely with sound and image combined, as has John Comfort as well. So just sort of to open that up to discussion.
It's for both of you. So, who wants?
Well, I can just jump in quickly with sort of responding to what you said about the yucky music, and I guess that was a bit of a loose response to basically Top 40 Radio, which is I think the soundtrack to service industry labor. So I guess that's where I'm kind of thinking about this rhythm of the songs. It's the same songs that play repeatedly within an hour. They're timed with commercials. Maybe it was my own haptic feeling, my own memory of hearing those songs and recognizing them. But also just it felt like in Matin Leather, the top 40 songs seemed at a kind of an acute disjuncture from the labor that was being performed. And to me, that felt like the time and rhythm of the labor restrictions imposed by capital, the time frames onto this workforce, and it's sort of being unworked through this passing of the cup of Mata. So I would say that in response. And I guess maybe I just think it's very, I mean, I think to maybe just revisit the issue of Pete Seeger's documentary, I think it's just, there's just this knife's edge, right? This knife's edge that I talked about at the beginning between the dignity of labor and its dehumanization. And I think, I mean, it's very difficult to sort of talk about like a form of working under plantation slavery that's being depicted and not having that referred to more explicitly. So maybe I'm erring on the side of being too judgmental, but I think that that history is so present, and yet the accounts that I've read of the making of this documentary is really about the cult of, maybe it's sort of post hoc, like the kind of ways in which it's been narrativized after its making, which sort of really focuses not on the names of the prisoners, but on Pete Seeger. And that troubles me, and that might undermine like the really good work that was obviously done in the documentary. But I guess I'm still sort of thinking about this moment of how to speak for, or how not to speak for, and yet speak to marginalized groups, which is a problematic I think we've sort of talked about earlier in this symposium.
I think the two musical examples that I selected, they kind of represent really paradigmatic examples of music which is which combines what I call this notion of a certain kind of emotional deadness combined with a certain kind of flamboyance, so that at every level, from delivery to tonality, they incarnate this notion of what they call trap music. So they are something like flamboyant performances of unfreedom, which I find seductive in their skillfulness. There's a kind of heroic bleakness about them that I find enchanting. And tactically speaking, separating them from image is a kind of invitation to hear into those sounds and to bring a form of attention to those sounds, which you know, one might be tempted to not do that. In other words, there was no way not to bring a kind of close listening, because it was just a tactical idea to shut off the visual channel in order to see what happens if you expand this the perceptual invitation to encounter their sonic complexity. It's music that's used to being ignored, which means that the invitation to listen to it is also an invitation to pay attention to the forms of ignoring, the forms of active ignoring that surround that music, and to bring that in relation to some of the videos that we can see here seemed a challenge worth taking up.
Thank you. We have to come to an end here, unfortunately. Time was, we expected that we didn't even realize it was so. It was so entertaining, and already 2.5 hours were over. In half an hour, the next session will take place. Thank you to you, and thank you for your attendance.